Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. At the time of recording, the Russian invasion of Ukraine is into its seventh day, and as we enter an increasingly brutal and drawn-out battle, in this edition, we're going to try to answer a number of important questions. Should we have seen this conflict coming, and should the West have done more to avoid this war? Are we seeing a seismic shift in the geopolitical order? And does this point to a century of intense conflict between liberal democracies and an illiberal group led by China and Russia? And has the media in the West provided proper information and background on this complex issue, or has it been clickbait and simplistic bombs mostly drawn from Ukrainian social media accounts? Joining us today, we are fortunate to have two people who thought deeply about all of this and far more. Scott Birchall is a former senior lecturer in international relations in the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at Deakin University. He's now an honorary fellow at Deakin. And Peter Harcher is the political editor and international editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Peter Harcher and Scott Birchall, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Pleasure, Monica.
Thank you.
Now, Scott, I'd like to start with you. Many people who've been watching this part of the world for some time have watched the tension build up, namely NATO expansionism, which Putin cites as having been a pressure on him to act, along with what he cites as a brutal war in the Donbass. Some have predicted this outcome. Not me, I have to say. I didn't think it would happen. But looking at it now and looking back at the past, say, 8 years of this low-level conflict in the Donbass, did you think it would come to this?
I thought there might be some activities on the border in the Donbass region. I was surprised that he went further than that. But in retrospect, when you look at what he's been saying over the last 8 years, it's quite clear that he regards Ukraine as a proxy state for NATO. Whether you agree with him or not is another debate, but clearly he does. And the point came where he was no longer prepared to accept what was going on in Ukraine. He was no longer prepared to accept the fact that no one was taking his warning seriously and that he wasn't really engaging with any parties to seriously address his concerns. So in retrospect, it appears to be less surprising, but I did get surprised. I was surprised by the extent to which it escalated from simply a border concern to a broader invasion.
And to what extent do you think he was angered by the apparent ignoring of the treaty that he put to Washington in December of 2021 when he wanted these two particular issues addressed?
Yes, look, I think his view is that particularly Minsk II, which is one of the key agreement that might have headed off some of these concerns, was not just neglected and ignored and opposed essentially by the Ukrainian government, but he felt they were doing so under US pressure. So he felt he was fighting essentially a diplomatic battle on two fronts, not just trying to convince the Ukrainians to take this seriously and debate it as a European-style solution to the problem, but he was also convinced, probably with some justification, I think, that the United States was behind the scenes in putting pressure on the Ukrainians and their European partners to ensure that this didn't go ahead. So he really had reached a block in progress, and he would say, I presume, that there was no other option for him other than to escalate to a military option.
Peter, what do you think? Do you think that Putin had no other strategic choice? Do you accept that argument?
Well, I think he'd actually achieved his stated goal with the 2014 invasions into Ukraine, because his stated goal is that he wants to guarantee that Ukraine never joins NATO. Well, as he would very well know, one of the conditions of joining NATO is that your borders are undisputed. Well, so long as there was a border dispute, and that was his forces occupying Crimea, his forces occupying the Donbass region, or at least his proxy forces, claiming them on behalf of Russia, that was a dispute on the border, over the borders of Ukraine. So Putin would know that under those circumstances, Ukraine could never have been admitted to NATO. So I don't buy his rationale.
I mean, it seems kind of pointless looking back into the past at causes, but actually, I think it's actually really important to look to go back and look at what's happened. I mean, in 2008, when Ukraine and Georgia were angling for entry to NATO, it's fair to say that much of Europe was kind of playing dead bat to the idea, but the US was dangling that carrot. Now, regardless of what happened in 2014, merely taking Crimea was not going to be enough in Putin's mind to stop NATO, you know, continuing, or the United States continuing to have influence in Ukraine. How significant was what happened in 2008, do you think, in Putin's minds, in Putin's mind to him? Scott, do you think it was important for him? Was he harping back in his own mind to 2008 when NATO was being dangled as a possibility for both Ukraine and Georgia?
I think his main problem is mistrusting the United States. And, you know, prior to the grabbing of Crimea, the role of the United States, particularly in the coup, which removed a pro-Russian president, was not unnoticed. I think that's really one of his key issues, that it wasn't that the Ukrainians were initiating a lot of this. He was convinced that the United States was behind it. There's some evidence, of course, that there were also indigenous neo-Nazi forces behind this. But there's also clear evidence that the United States was working behind the scenes to ensure that the Ukrainian government was led by someone they approved of. And from his historical point of view, this is further evidence of momentum towards a further movement of Western influence. It's not just about NATO. It's about Western influence moving east towards the border of Russia. And he's a guy who clearly has an understanding of history. It may not be one we all share, but he clearly sees it as he had to somehow draw a line and decide where that line was going to be drawn. And, you know, he caught a lot of people off guard. Maybe he thought he would get a relatively easy military victory. But certainly from it seems to be that his motivation was that if he didn't draw the line somewhere, this sort of inexorable move of Western influence through NATO and through political influence of the United States was moving against Russia's strategic and political interests.
And much of that, of course, is based on his own interpretation of the historical antecedents of Ukraine. What do you make of those, Scott?
Well, you know, we can debate nationalism for ages, and the fact that most states are confections, which don't go back very long. Many nationalist narratives are based on myths and modern history and inventions, and that applies to all states. So, if we go down that route, of course, you could start to question the legitimacy of many countries in the world. But remember, if he's as a student of history, he's probably thinking, well, hang on, what happened in 1974 when Turkey invaded Cyprus? Well, what happened? Did they get sanctions? Did they get kicked out of NATO? Were they kicked out of the island? Well, no, to all three. So he's able to, Turkey's able to occupy northern Cyprus since 1974 without being subject to diplomatic or economic sanctions. No other state in the world recognizes it, but it doesn't change anything. So he's probably thinking, well, hang on a minute, if they can get away with it and Cyprus is in the heart of Europe, why can't I get away with something which clearly has similar ethnic arguments behind it, but also obviously has a direct strategic interest as well.
So, Peter, a lot of people would say that's just whataboutism. What do you make of that?
Well, that's all well and good, but we've so far neglected. You can always come up with a historical pretext or precedent for anything, but we've so far neglected a couple of important little details, such as international law, the UN Charter, to which Russia is a signatory, the fact that Ukraine is a sovereign state which has been recognized as an independent sovereign state by Russia itself in 1991, the fact that Russia is not only a member of the UN and signed up to the UN Charter, but is a permanent member of the UN Security Council, and yet it has blatantly and unambiguously violated all the principal elements of the UN Charter, as the Secretary General Antonio Guterres himself pointed out the moment the Russian invasion began. So, look, you can buy into Putin's mythology. Putin has justified the invasion by saying that Ukraine is forever part of our historical, social, and spiritual space. So there you go, spiritual space. You've there got a supernatural justification for invading a sovereign country next door. I mean, if you cop that, you'll cop anything. This is a clear-cut violation of the international law and the international charter. And if you accept his terms, and Scott's earlier point that he saw an inexorable slide of Ukraine out of his orbit into the West, into Europe, even if you accept that pretext, accept that as a point, well, the greatest influence in accelerating Ukraine's move into the Western orbit was Putin's invasion of Ukraine in 2014, because before that, support among the Ukrainian public for joining NATO was, in opinion polling, was fewer than 20%, less than 20%. But recently, after Putin's invasion of Ukraine in 2014, public opinion was over 60%, close to 70% in favor of joining NATO. So it's Putin's aggression that has pushed Ukraine towards the West more than any other factor. So all of this is a pretext. And my final sentence on this, Monica, is we've talked about the past a lot. I think Putin's immediate political future was probably at least as big and possibly even greater a factor in this.
In what way, Peter? What makes you say that?
Well, he's a politician facing re-election the year after next. And, you know, he's got a number of problems, including the stagnation in the Russian economy, including the fact that he's got the key opposition leader, of course, Alexei Navalny, locked up, and a protest movement that he's managed to repress, but that there's a strong strand of protest thinking and anti-regime thinking running through the country that he's keen to continue repressing. And the evidence for that is that even as his troops have been moving into Ukraine in this last week, he's had Navalny in the Russian courts on more trumped-up charges to keep him in jail even longer beyond the next election. So that's clear evidence that he's got the domestic opposition in mind. Now, you know, he knows from 2014 that if he wages war on Ukraine, his opinion polling goes up and his popularity in Russia goes up. I mean, he's just another politician. And there you go.
Scott, what do you make of that? Do you think that domestic concerns have factored into this?
Well, I'm sure they, in all politicians, are concerned about their political base and the levels of support. I'm not sure he's calculated well in this case, because he may have been surprised, I think, by the anti-war movement, in its embryonic form within Russia today. But of course he's concerned about that. But, you know, he doesn't even need to look at history. He can see Mr. Trump recognizing the illegal acquisition by Israel of the Golan Heights, which is part of Syria. And this is not history. This is very recent, something that the Biden administration, for example, has gone on to continue to acknowledge. Clear violation of international law, a clear attack on anything you might call the rules-based international order. We had Trump's attacks on the International Criminal Court. So, you know, I think the West is in absolutely no position to lecture Putin on international law or violations of sovereignty. We do many more than he has. We perhaps, and we do them much more violently. So that's all very well. We can have a discussion about that, but really we're in no position. When you look at Libya, you look at Iraq, Afghanistan, you look at Serbia, you look at East Timor, Western Sahara today, West Papua, we're in no position to be raising these questions about international law and the status of the rules-based international order, because we're the worst offenders by a long way, by a long way. I mean, we just hope that the casualties in Ukraine don't reach the levels in Gaza City or Raqqa. We just hope that's the case. And they're, of course, the ones that we're responsible for and, of course, the ones we should give priority to because we can actually change them.
So do you think that he's just kind of miscalculated here what the noise would be around what he's done, that he thought that the West would kind of, there'd be a bit of noise, but ultimately the West wouldn't end up doing very much? Peter, can I put that question to you?
Probably he's as surprised as the rest of us that Germany has reacted as swiftly and decisively as it has. It took less than 72 hours for the new German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, a centre-left leader, for goodness sake, to abandon post-war Germany's entire philosophy of post-war pacifism and post-Cold War inertia on security and defence policy. It was an astonishing transformation. He has not only dumped long-standing and deeply held German policy about shipping arms so that, you know, Germany decided within 72 hours not only to directly supply defensive munitions to Ukraine, but also to dump its long-standing ban on allowing third countries. So, for example, German-made equipment, defense equipment, missiles, guns, whatever that it's had sold to Estonia. Estonia wanted to send to Ukraine to support the Ukrainians in the last week, but they were banned because it was German equipment and the Germans have this ban on their customers, third countries exporting their goods, their military goods without permission. Well, Germany's now dumped that provision and any German arms in the world can now be sold on to Ukraine. But much, you know, above and beyond all of that is that he has dumped the unofficial guidance on defence spending, which had limited German defence outlays to 1% of GDP for many years, announced that it would be doubled within 3 years, and as an immediate advance on that, put 100 billion euros on the table in the Parliament and said this is going to be our immediate increase in defence spending.
So, Peter, is that to you more significant, what Germany has done, is that more significant in your eyes than the array of other sanctions that have been imposed that are utterly crippling the Russian economy?
Well, the transformation of Germany, which is, of course, the superpower of Europe and the centrepiece of Europe, the transformation of Germany within 3 days has been astonishing and surprising to people around the world, including, I suspect, to Vladimir Putin. As for the effectiveness of sanctions, I think that the two killer sanctions for Putin are financial. Number one, so far at least, was the decision by the Europeans and the US and associated allies to shut the Russian central bank out of the global financial system. Mm-hmm. This means that the carefully stockpiled $630 billion foreign exchange reserve that Putin had built up in his central bank in anticipation of just such a day is largely unavailable to him. Only the reserves that he's holding with China and in Chinese-denominated assets might be readily available if the Chinese decide to go ahead and honour those, which I assume they will. The rest will largely be unavailable to him, and that means so the ruble collapses, the central bank can't intervene, it won't have the firepower to keep supporting it. That means they can't afford the imports that they need. That is, in the words of a former US official I talked to this week, David Asher, who's been involved in many financial sanctions campaigns over the years, he said that's an economic act of war.
And it is interesting, isn't it, that we are seeing, I think this quite possibly for the first time, where you have military warfare up against economic warfare. Scott, how do you see that, and who comes out on top? Because surely somebody has to.
Sanctions can work two ways. They can, in fact, obviously cripple your economy, and the Russian economy is under enormous stress through the banking system, as Peter explained. But they can also galvanize people behind the leader. They can actually push people together in a common against a common enemy. It's not hard for you don't even have to be a demagogue, really. You can be just a populist to sort of gather public opinion on your side against these external threats. They can work both ways. Economic sanctions in the past have been used, obviously, against South Africa, and they were effective, particularly in the finance sector, although you can't underestimate the work done by the ANC, the PAC, and all the other anti-apartheid groups on the ground there. So it was a combination of the two. I guess the question then is does this narrow the time frame that he has to achieve whatever he defines as victory in Ukraine? Is he having to push this harder than faster than he probably otherwise would be, because Russians are now finding there's no money in the ATMs, they can't use their credit cards, there's long queues outside the banks, people trying to get their money out. So maybe what in the short term the sanctions will do is drive people to a common sense of where we're being isolated, we're being picked on again. But also, this is for Putin narrowing his time frame for whatever he has in mind when he talks about victory in Ukraine.
So do you think any of that, though, indicates that just will harden people's views towards him? They're already pretty hard in some quarters, that this is just going to entirely destabilize his regime?
Look, it's really hard to know how thorough the anti-war sentiment is. Clearly, the middle class is going to be affected because it's used to now, buying its goods and the consumer markets in the same way everyone else is in relatively affluent Western societies. So they will be noticing something that the censorship of their media is not telling them. And that is that something is really untoward is going on here, and we're being severely punished by external forces. But as we know in Russian history, having the world against you is not something that they quickly buckle in the face of. So Putin's task will be twofold. One is to carry on a successful military operation in Ukraine, and secondly, assure the public that the short-term pain that they're experiencing is not going to last, and that it's something that the world tends to always use against us because they don't understand our interests.
Of course, it's not just economic pain, though. I was talking to a friend in Russia last night who said, at the moment, people don't care, but once those coffins start coming back, they'll care, and that's when he's going to be in deep trouble. Peter, do you see, from the way you're looking at this issue, that his regime may get so unstable that his own people will move on him?
Oh, it's entirely possible. History is full of such events, and if recent events, starting with perhaps the election of Donald Trump, haven't taught us that anything is possible, then nothing will. I think we just should have accept that anything now is possible in world politics. Look, it is a distinct possibility, of course. There'll be food shortages, there'll be hardship. They won't have energy shortages, but they'll have a lot of other shortages if these economic sanctions are kept in place. And if, as you say, it turns into another Chechen war or another Russian invasion of Afghanistan scenario, where it's long, difficult progress, and where bodies are coming home in the thousands, then yes, it's entirely possible that combination of forces could topple his regime. And Monica, I realize I nominated in an earlier answer to you that there were two killer financial sanctions. I listed one. The second one is Switzerland's transformation. Switzerland, for the first time, has joined Europe and the West. It's effectively dumped its neutrality and certainly dumped its banking secrecy laws and said, we're going to sign on to your banking sanctions against Russia, Putin, and his cronies. And financial sanctions experts say that much of Putin's money, maybe most of it, that he's been, the great kleptocrat has been pulling out of the Russian economy for more than 20 years now is in Swiss bank accounts. It must be not only personally deeply disturbing to Putin that now those accounts are frozen, if they're in any way identified with him or his cronies, including the cellist, the famously and inexplicably wealthy cellist, who's known as Putin's wallet, who's been named as having an estimated net worth of $3.3 billion. I don't know about how many cellists you know who who have $3 billion in assets, but it seems like a lot of fast fiddling to me. But that's just one example. So it's not just Putin's money, but I think the larger signal this sends is these sanctions increase the cost to anybody of being close to Putin. If any oligarch or anybody is close to Putin and Putin is enriching them as a result of their loyalty, their assets, their ability to move around the world, their ability to travel, to use their assets outside Russia, is now under threat. So to go to your question, is this regime at risk now? Well, that's yet another factor that will discourage powerful people wanting to be close to Putin.
Scott, what role do you think the oligarchs will play in all of this?
Well, almost all of them have close links with Putin. So it's the absence of an alternative, which is one of his great strengths, of course, is the elimination of political opponents, discrediting of political opponents. Most of those oligarchs who've made their billions have done so only because of his position. So, if he goes down, they go down. If he goes up, they come up again. They've obviously laundered their money through London, and I noticed that the British government is giving them a stay of execution in one of the banks there to pending any events that might come up. But can I just say one thing about the German sanctions or the German decision to change its military position here in terms of exporting arms? That is significant. I agree with Peter. It's a very important change, but it also works another way. It's not going to go down well in Russia to find that they are up against German armaments after they have memories of World War II or the Great Patriotic War, as they call it. I thought that decision by Scholz was very naive, and I think he's obviously a leader with his training wheels at this point. He hasn't been around long. But if you were Putin wanting to gather public opinion behind you against the pernicious influence of the West, having Germany selling armaments to your military opponents is a temptation to exploit, I think, that he'll find hard to resist.
Can I ask you both, actually, on that point of Germany, whether you think that had Merkel still been Chancellor, A, this would have happened, and B, what her reaction might have been? Peter?
Well, she'd a hallmark of her time was to go out of her way to avoid antagonising Putin. Not just Putin, she'd also notably cultivated Xi Jinping's China. She would have been reluctant, I think, very reluctant. All her instincts would have been to resist this course. But if you look at the change in public opinion in Germany and across Europe, in fact, across most of the world, there is just such absolute outrage at what Putin has done. He's just violated every conception of not only international law, but humanity, that I think any leader of Germany would have been forced to react. And I suppose it's just such a surprise in Germany's particular case at this moment that it happened so quickly and under a centre-left leader who'd been very timorous about Russia, China, been reluctant to say breathe a critical word, and it transformed in 72 hours. It was the speed and the decisiveness with which he moved that really amazed me. Mm. But to answer your question, yeah, I think Merkel would have been slower and more reluctant.
Mm. Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think Merkel would stand up to the Americans as well, unlike Scholz, who's not in that position yet. But I suspect she would have been forced to impose sanctions like everyone else. Whether she would have started exporting military equipment to Ukraine, I think, is highly unlikely. But we also need to understand there's another issue at play here, and that is Russian gas supplies to Western Europe. Mm. And how Whether or not Mr. Putin turns off the gas spigot is an issue we have to consider. If it had been obviously early winter, it might have been a very different scenario. They're obviously moving into spring and summer, but there's no easy alternative to the massive energy supplies that Western Europe buys from Russia in the short term. And that's an issue that Putin has not yet dangled in front of them, but he may well do.
Okay, let's just move on to a final area of questioning, the main game. What is it here? I've got my views, but I'm really interested in hearing from both of you. You know, is it a reordering of great power? Are we moving into a different world, one that is shaped by China and Russia on the one hand, and the United States and Europe on the other? Peter, can I start with you on that one?
I think there's only one man on the planet who can answer that question. And unfortunately, Monica, it's not me, not even Scott. it's a fellow called Xi Jinping. I think he is the pivotal figure he is the hinge in deciding which way the world swings on this. At the moment, so obviously we know that China is the dominant partner in that partnership with Russia. Its economy is almost exactly 10 times bigger, $16 trillion annual GDP versus Russia's 1.6 trillion, which is it's about the same size as Australia. So China is by far the dominant partner. Now, with all these sanctions being applied to Russia today, China has the ability to either step in as the banker of last resort and fully support and supply Russia and therefore rescue Putin and keep his regime alive, or he could go entirely the other way, decide that Putin's now radioactive and break the relationship or somewhere in between. But all those options are available to him. And the first of those, to fully support and embrace Putin in the face of global sanctions, must be tempting because he would be able at this point to turn Russia into a full vassal state at a very discounted price, and make it a true subordinate, dependent on Xi Jinping himself. But you know, to do that would mean that he would have to be ready to accelerate his confrontation with the West, and he may not be ready for that.
Right. Okay. And do you think it's now clear that China, for example, knew that this action in Ukraine was going to happen? You convinced of that now?
Well, I think they must have had some discussion about it. I don't know how far it went, of course, but military analysts have pointed out again and again that some of the troops that Russia has put onto Ukraine's border and now into Ukraine were moved from Russia's borders with China. And I'm assuming that they would have discussed that at the opening night of the Beijing Olympics, where Putin turned up, shook hands with Xi Jinping, and they declared their so-called No Limits Pact. I'm assuming that they discussed there that Putin would have said to Xi Jinping, I'm going to be moving some troops to my east, and I don't know how far he went in explaining the rationale, but would have looked for some reassurance that first he would have seen an obligation to explain to his new best friend, although they've called each other best friend for years now, but also to get some dispensation to make sure that China would do nothing to take advantage of that.
Scott, what's the main game here? What are we looking at?
Just a couple of points. One is, I think Putin's surprised by the international reaction. When he moved into Georgia and Chechnya, the West didn't seem to care very much. So he's surprised by the difference here. On the other hand, he doesn't respond to public opinion in the same way the West does. So he's probably thinks he has a freer hand. One other point about it, remember, we've been hearing all these stories that under the coverage of or the cover of the Ukraine war, China would retake Taiwan. I think that was one of the great journalistic blunders of the period. There's no evidence that this is going to happen, those who push that line should explain why they actually, on what basis they make the claim. And the final point I would make is we now have 1 million refugees in Ukraine. And if you want to get the attention of the West to resolve an issue, and particularly Europeans, even though they may be more well-disposed to Ukrainian refugees than they are to Syrian refugees, the mass movement of people across borders and into neighbouring states is going to be one that a factor that will also encourage, I think, some of the countries in the region to seek an early and encourage an early resolution of this conflict regardless of whether others want to push it back and keep bleeding Putin as long as they can. So keep an eye on the refugees issue, because I think the numbers are just escalating every day.
And a final question, truly a final question to both of you, in terms of the media coverage of this war in the last week. Peter, what do you make of it? There's been a little bit of criticism about, but it hasn't been that loud. But, you know, if it seems to most people that what we're seeing in terms of media coverage is almost entirely from Ukraine's perspective. What do you make of what you've been reading, seeing, hearing?
Well, it has largely been from the Ukrainian perspective, that's true. Partly that's got to do with the difficulty of independent media operating freely within Russia. But it's natural, I suppose, that in a war, the journalistic and news interest is, you know, the basic definition of news, I think, Monica, is what's going wrong in the world. And so you go to where the thing is going wrong, and the thing going wrong is in Ukraine. So I think that's, you know, entirely natural and normal and to be understood. Broadly, I think it's been pretty good. I think there have been some flourishes of excess, but broadly, I think it's been reasonably straight and reasonably factual.
Okay, Scott.
I think we assumed that somehow this war would just be a blitzkrieg, and therefore when it didn't live up to our expectations, we decided that Mr. Putin was failing. I think we ought to reconsider that, and that he may in fact have a very different idea of how to impose his will in Ukraine. A couple of points. If you want to get more information out of Russia, why censor their TV and radio stations in the West? I mean, you know, the crazy banning of Russia TV or Russia Today is in the West is just simply a show of some sort of lack of confidence that we can't be exposed to views that may be different to the ones that we're supposed to absorb. And the cult of Zelensky is interesting. He's being portrayed as a sort of some new Gandhi or new master of the 21st century. It's interesting how the West tends to focus on individuals because that's the easiest way of presenting things. But it would be nice to have a little bit more balanced view about the administration of President Zelensky, some of the people behind him, for example, rather than just portray him as this incredibly courageous person, almost single-handedly standing up to the Russian army.
Well, he certainly is courageous. But do you think that the overwhelming Ukrainian social media presence, clearly a win for it, but do you think that's kind of driving expectations both in the West and inside Ukraine that Ukraine will win this?
Well, it's driving it in the West, but it's kind of irrelevant because, yeah, okay, we're fully embraced of social media and we form views based on this, but that has no impact on what events on the ground are occurring in Ukraine today. And I'm sure that Mr. Putin's least concern is the impact of some of these TikToks and YouTube videos that are circulating around. He knows that he has the upper hand militarily. He's obviously got a particular strategy. It may not meet the expectations that we have about how he was going to conduct the war, but that's our fault, not his. So I think we need to have a more objective analysis, and we need to avoid things, you know, exaggerating deaths and be very skeptical about the casualty rates on both sides before we start drawing any conclusions about whether or not the campaign is going well for the Russians or for the Ukrainians. But clearly the numbers would suggest that at some point in the next week, the Russians will be in control of as much of the territory of Ukraine as they want to be.
Peter, any final comment from you on that?
Well, just to, I would certainly agree that social media is a very short-sighted, fast-moving phenomenon that that simply exaggerates the present moment and has a great deal of difficulty establishing any sort of real perspective. Absolutely. So you get all sorts of distortions and exaggerations. But on Scott's point that Putin doesn't care what the impression is of him or whether his campaign is successful or failing or whatever, I would disagree with that. Putin's one of the fundamental and consistent elements of Putin's modus operandi from day one has been to always appear tough, always appear strong. Strength is, whether it's him taking his shirt off to flex or whether it's the intimidation that he's used in this slow military build-up. Three times in the last month, threatening nuclear war, either directly or hinting at it. All of this and all of the other bluster is all designed at looking tough and strong, and anything that undercuts that injures his entire tough guy projection and the basis on which he's built his reputation as a fearsome strongman.
Mm. Well, on that note, I'd like to say thank you to both of you for the conversation. It was fascinating, and I'm sure that we'll come back to both of you at some point in the next month or so. We'll see how it all goes. Thank you both, Scott Birchall.
Thanks, Monica.
Peter Hartcher.
Pleasure, Monica.
And on that note, I'd like to thank Scott Birchall and Peter Hartcher for being on the program. And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, who we thank for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk media, politics, and of course, everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle there is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to my producer, Marlene Evan, and the executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Monica Attard. Thank you for listening.